This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
With fall in full swing, more moments call for more comfort. Mack Weldon's got you covered with comfortable, easy-to-layer clothes designed for cooler days and timeless style. Their new Ace line, inspired by their best-selling sweatpants, combines everyday comfort with long-lasting and confident looks you can count on. For over a decade, Mack Weldon has designed timeless, innovative menswear to help you move through the day with confidence. Not flashy, just classic, always in style, and made from the world's most comfortable performance materials. Fall into comfort with Mack Weldon's Ace Collection. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 20% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MackWeldon.com, promo code MACK25.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 135, The Rise of the Elephant King. Thank you all for bearing with me while I reconfigured some things here. This autumn did a number on me in my day job and completely threw off the routine I had established for podcasting. I have settled into a new pattern, and everything should be moving forward with a little bit more consistency. Even with the holidays coming up, I don't expect too much disruption. In fact, I usually tend to get a lot of work done this time of year. Go figure. Side note, if you want things like some petty day job to interfere less with the show, check out hopfulmedia.com.co and subscribe, donate, or buy some merch. The more of that you do, the less day job I need to have. Anyway, it's been a minute since we had an official narrative episode. We last checked in with Seleucus in episode 131 with his war against Antigonus Monophthalmos and Demetrius for dominance in Babylon. Seleucus came out on top in that conflict and even had some time to solidify military control of central Iran while he was at it. Then, in episode 133, we had a Meet the Neighbors special explaining what all of Alexander the Great's other ex-followers were up to, mostly declaring themselves kings, and why Antigonus never came back for a third round of fighting in Mesopotamia. The Aegean Basin exploded into violence as everyone claimed a crown for themselves, and Antigonus, Demetrius, and Ptolemy all claimed literal godhood. That episode went all the way up to 301 BCE, and ended with the dramatic foreshadowing that Seleucus would arrive in the West with a giant elephant army. Spoiler, this episode will end in a very similar place. Last week, another Meet the Neighbors special gave us a primer on the Maurya Empire in India, the latest dynasty to rise out of the imperial heartland of Magadha and start spreading in all directions. In that episode, I mentioned, but skipped over, how Chandragupta Maurya, Samrat of India, conquered the West. Surprise, that's what was keeping Seleucus busy while his old friends tried to kill one another in the Mediterranean. Or at least, that was a major part of it. Exactly how long it took for Seleucus and Chandragupta to fight it out is a matter for debate. Today, we need to tie all of those stories together And to do that, we return to Seleucus at the end of the Babylonian War in 309 BCE. So, Seleucus took over Babylon, fought some people between there and Bactria, did a war with India, cut a deal with Chandragupta, and marched west in search of glorious victory. The end. Okay, you can see the timestamp, so you know that I'll do a little more than that. But that summary really is just about all we get from the sources. And when I say sources, I mean modern secondary and tertiary documents too. Even Paul J. Cosman's Land of the Elephant Kings, which is a book about how the Seleucids viewed and partitioned their territory, barely says a word about how the Indian border was actually settled. And there is a reason for that. We quite simply don't actually know. Even our surviving ancient sources, including fragmentary quotations from Megasthenes, the Seleucid ambassador to the Maurya court, say nothing about this conflict beyond it happened. And yet, it represents one of the most significant shifts in this entire podcast and ancient history more broadly. It's not like a major dynastic change, but it is the single most significant change in Iran's political borders up to this point, knocking the Athenian conquests in the 5th century to a distant second. So this episode is going to be a lot of me postulating on my own based on the scraps I could get from research. Part of the lack of detail comes down to the usual suspects. India was too far from the Greco-Roman authors to get reliable information. The Babylonian sources in the middle are largely lost to time. The Indian sources now acknowledge that there is a West, which is an improvement, but they still aren't interested in it. The thing is, the Greek sources weren't nearly as interested in it as they might have been a decade earlier either. When Antigonus defeated Eumenes and conquered the East, he carried out a purge of the existing satraps, left there by Alexander. So a lot of Alexander's companions, the people who captured the imaginations of later historians, were gone by the time Seleucus returned to Babylon. On top of impacting our sources, it also means that the new king in Babylon, or more accurately, the satrap who would declare himself king a year later, inherited a fraught political situation when the Babylonian War ended in 309. We know even less about that than we do about the Indian border. At least Chandragupta is dynamic enough as a historical figure that he provides fuel for speculation. Justin mentions that Seleucus fought a war in Bactria around this time, and we get absolutely no further information to speak of. There is a single sentence in all of our ancient sources describing this period between 309 and 305. It's not even clear if Justin means that Seleucus fought the satrapy of Bactria specifically, or if he's using the traditional Greek sense of Bactria as vaguely somewhere in northeastern Iran and Central Asia. So this could include anything from the Dahai Saka on the Caspian Sea, Khorasmia near the Aral, Margiana, Sogdia, any of it. All get kind of lumped in together as Bactria in this context. We have direct references from the description of the war with Antigonus, establishing that Persis, Susiana, and Media all submitted to Seleucus before 309. And Evagoras, the satrap of Aria installed by Alexander, died in battle during the Babylonian War. So we can assume that Seleucus exploited the power vacuum to seize control of the northwestern corner of modern Iran, too. We hear nothing about the more southern provinces in Drangiana and Gedrosia, or the specific satrapies around the Caspian Basin. We just know that at some point they submitted to Seleucid authority. It's not even clear if Seleucus was fighting Stasinor, the Macedonian satrap of Bactria, or one of the local warlords in the area who started minting their own coins around this time, probably fighting Stasinor. Or Seleucus might have fought all of them to get the northeast back in line. Potentially the most tantalizing pieces of evidence come before Seleucus became king of the upper satrapies. The Indian drama, known as the Mudrara Kshasa, claims that Chandragupta began by conquering the Punjab and/or the whole Indus Valley. Justin appears to claim that Chandragupta's conflict against Alexander the Great's governors began as soon as Alexander died. A few modern historians have even suggested that the rebellions against Alexander while he was still in the Punjab were tied to Chandragupta. That's a bit less likely than it coming a few years later, but we just don't know. As I discussed last time, there is evidence to suggest that Chandragupta and his premier Chanakya had an existing base of operations in the northwestern subcontinent. So this isn't outside the realm of possibility. I also discussed how the Mudrara Kshasa is loaded with anachronisms. Justin's epitome is a summary of an older text, so it may be compressing details quite a bit. Whatever the case, it certainly cannot have been as total a conquest of the Indus as the Mudrara Kshasa suggests. All through the wars of the Diadochoi, Indian units under Macedonian generals have played their part. Eudemus in the Indus Valley and Pathon, son of Agenor in Gandhara, were still there during the war between Antigonus and Eumenes in the early 310s. Eudemus notably brought a force of Indian soldiers to join Eumenes in Iran, and Pathon was still in India when Antigonus summoned him to replace Seleucus as satrap of Babylon. Eudemus and Eumenes actually provide some of our first hints that something was going on in the Indus Valley before Seleucus started expanding his power. Sometime between 321 and 318 BCE, Eudemus, as Macedonian satrap of India, started to consolidate power for himself. While major players were dealing with the first and second wars of the Diadochoi, Eudemus defeated or assassinated the major players in the Punjab. Porus, the Indian king who had so thoroughly challenged and impressed Alexander in battle that his kingdom expanded as a Macedonian vassal, fell first. This was sometime during or just after the First War of the Diadochoi, which gave Eudemus full control of the Punjab. Omphis, the vassal king of Taxila, fell to Eudemus shortly before the satrap took his armies west to join Eumenes. The timeline here is very curious with regard to Chandragupta Maurya's own conquest. Chandragupta at least started recruiting in the area around Taxila, and according to Jain tradition, he was allied with Parvataka. Some historians identify Parvataka with the Porus, but even if you don't go that far, we know from Arian and Quintus Curtius Rufus that multiple kings in the Punjab went by that name. Chandragupta was busy with his second campaign against the Nanda Empire at the time that Eudemus supposedly took Porus's kingdom. Given the shortage of information, it is entirely plausible that Porus and his army marched east with Chandragupta, and Eudemus took that opportunity to strike at Porus's kingdom while he was away. The Jain sources all agree that Chanakya had Parvataka assassinated, But this would hardly be the only time a Greek took credit for mysterious events in the East if Eudemus said that he did it himself. The defeat of King Omphis and Eudemus' conquest of Taxila comes at an even more intriguing point in the Chandragupta timeline. Omphis was defeated around 318 BCE, right around the time that Chandragupta was expanding his empire for the first time. Every source agrees that Chandragupta was a prominent student in Taxila in the years before the Macedonian invasion. This could have been Eudemus just consolidating his power and taking the last independently powerful city in his lands, but by this time, Eudemus controlled the whole Indus Valley around Taxila. Omphis could not have realistically challenged Macedonian rule on his own, but he could have been hoping for outside support when Chandragupta started marching toward the Indus. Omphis declaring in favor of the Maurya Empire would certainly explain why Eudemus stepped in to seize Taxila before leaving India altogether. Speaking of Eudemus's trip west, he joined Eumenes in Iran and became one of the generals to betray his new commander to Antigonus. Eudemus and his co-conspirator Antigonus were put to death alongside many of Antigonus' most oppositional soldiers in the Silver Shields, which was Macedon's Royal Guard Corps. Their third co-conspirator against Eumenes was Theotomus. He was spared by Antigonus. After all, they couldn't execute every Silver Shield, so Theotomus was put in command of the now-disgraced guard unit when they were sent to Arachosia. Satrap Sibirtius was instructed to send small units of Silver Shields on suicide missions to slowly wipe them out with minimal dishonor. That does raise the question of what was going on in Arachosia that required so many suicide missions. Well, Arachosia is the border province between the rest of Iran and the northern passes through the Hindu Kush. And we are now in 316 BCE. Depending on the timeline you accept for the Mauryan invasion of Macedon's territory, the war may have been very brief and a decade later, or quite protracted. In the latter case, 316 is right around the time that Chandragupta would have been assaulting Macedonian India. Based on the outcome of the war, I've never really understood the argument for the shorter, later interpretation of the conflict. The Mauryan Empire gained too much through negotiation if they had barely touched the Indus in 305 BC. However, 316 would be the perfect time to strike. The satrap of the Indus Valley had just been executed, and his army was broken and on its way further west with Antigonus. Oxiathres, the father-in-law of Alexander the Great, was likely a very old man or just dead in his satrapy of Peripamisidae near modern Kabul. We don't hear anything about Gandhara after Pathon left for Babylon. These satrapies were neglected, weakened, and vulnerable even before Eudemus destroyed their military base. It was the perfect time for Chandragupta to invade and sweep through the remaining Macedonians in the region, and even to press his advance up into the mountains. So we know that the political situation was primed for an invasion. We know that Chandragupta was on the warpath, and we know that the Silver Shields were being thrown against some very dangerous threat in or around the Arachosian border. I think that makes war between Chandragupta and Antigonid forces the most likely explanation here. Of course, wars, and generally being in the 4th century BCE, really slow down the flow of information across West Asia. So when Seleucus left Babylon in 316, he had probably heard a little bit about the dynastic shift in far eastern India and Eudemus' apparent conflict with Chandragupta's allies in the Indus Valley. Then, when he got back to Babylon in 309, he started hearing about how the Mauryan armies were pushing through the mountains and attacking on the western side. But before he could even deal with that problem, there were a half dozen satrapies to get back in line across Iran and Central Asia. So we will explore what little we know about the coming war after a quick break. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. We are back, and we are just about to start the Seleucid-Mauryan War. This is the part where the ancient sources just kind of hand-wave away the details of whatever conflict came next, and unfortunately, I don't really have a choice but to do the same. Most of the sources just say something to the effect of, "And Seleucus fought Chandragupta," the Greek name for Chandragupta. One source, and a name that everyone should get used to hearing, has a little more to say that has puzzled historians for generations. In the Syrian Wars, the Roman historian Appian wrote, "He crossed the Indus and waged war with Chandragupta, king of the Indians, who lived on the banks of that river, until they came to an agreement with one another and contracted a marriage pact. Some of these events were enacted before the death of Antigonus, and others afterwards." This is interesting for a few reasons. One, it implies that the treaty negotiations that ended the Seleucid-Mauryan War were ongoing when Seleucus returned to the west. But we also know that the Seleucid army that went west had already benefited from that agreement. It's not clear what Appian means by events enacted after Antigonus' death. It could mean that they didn't finalize the marriage arrangements until later, that would make a lot of sense, or maybe there were ongoing border skirmishes for several years after the overall peace agreement. That would also make sense when you're dealing with a brand new border. The more puzzling part of Appian's claim comes from the line, "He crossed the Indus." As the historian John D. Granger points out in his biography of Seleucus, this geographic claim does not make sense in light of all the known conflicts predating Seleucus's reconquest of Babylon. From what little information we do have, it sounds like Chandragupta's forces had already crossed the Indus and were pushing through Gandhara at this point. Seleucus even getting across the Indus safely is a dubious claim, and once he was there, he would have been firmly in Mauryan territory, with one of the largest rivers in the world at his back, cutting off any hope of escape if the battle turned against him. Crossing the Indus would have been a terrible strategic decision. However, many later authors from the Roman period tend to use the Indus as shorthand for the border between India and the West, regardless of geopolitical reality. So Seleucus probably didn't cross the actual Indus. If he had, it would mean that the war was going much more successfully. In reality, we don't even know if there was a pitched battle of any sort, or just a series of increasingly heated border skirmishes. Seleucus did go east at the head of a large army, but it is entirely possible that he and Chandragupta came to an agreement before they actually fought. On one hand, that doesn't really align with ancient claims of a war between the two great powers. On the other, campaigning against an actual imperial power in the Hindu Kush to get back to the Indus Valley might have been a sobering experience for Seleucus. When he first fought there with Alexander, they were up against a loose collection of tribes, city-states, and minor kingdoms. The full force of the Mauryan Empire arrayed against them, with no flow of reinforcements from Europe like Alexander enjoyed, may have made Seleucus realize that the Indian border provinces just weren't worth the effort it would take to hold on to them. The other option is that there was a pitched battle, and Chandragupta dealt a quick and decisive blow against the Seleucid army. Because the ultimate outcome was, as I said earlier, the single largest loss of territory we have seen in the entire run of this podcast so far, not counting whole empires being conquered. Seleucus ceded all of the Indian satrapies. Hindush, Satagadiya, Gandhara, and even the recently formed Parapamisadai. However, the land cessations did not stop there. The Indo-Iranic border territories also went to Chandragupta. Arachosia, a long-standing Iranian stronghold in the east and likely home to the last vestiges of native Avestan speakers, fell to Maurya control, as did the eastern coastal plain of Gedrosia between modern Karachi and the Gulf of Oman, possibly as far as the southern side of the Strait of Hormuz. Arachosia is understandable. It's a source of mineral wealth and some of the first fertile lowlands on the western side of the mountains. It's obviously desirable from the Mauryan perspective. Gedrosia is usually ignored by historians. In part, I think, just because it seems like an odd area to contest from a classical perspective. We mostly hear about it in the context of Alexander's perilous desert crossing. The coastline here is home to a number of natural harbors that would have been very valuable to the Mauryans. Chandragupta probably had no expectation of conquering the entire Seleucid Empire and seizing the Persian Gulf for himself. That's just unrealistic. So the Seleucids maintained their grip on the Strait of Hormuz and trade in and out of the Gulf itself. But by ceding eastern Gedrosia, the Indians gained outposts that could be used to control trade between their territory and Persia, Mesopotamia, and Arabia. The far northwestern extent of the Mauryan borders is a matter for debate. Since some ancient authors include the province of Arya in the treaty and others do not. The most likely explanation I've seen is that the fortress capital of Arya, near modern Herat, was given to Chandragupta and the rest of the province was split, merging its Seleucid administration with Drangiana. The final picture depends on how generous you want to be with the exact borders, but a lot of this area is also kind of inhospitable no man's land, even today. They may have closely followed the western edge of the Hindu Kush, or they could have extended further west, creating a line that looks a lot like the eastern borders of modern Iran with Pakistan and Afghanistan. The northern border between the Maurya and Seleucid Bactria is generally understood to follow the Kabul River, and probably the long east-to-west stretch of the Hari River if we accept that Chandragupta took Arya. Basically, if you're following on a modern map, the northern quarter of modern Afghanistan remained in Seleucid hands. Chandragupta also came out on the winning side in the marriage negotiations. Generally speaking, in royal marriage contracts, the more prestigious side marries the daughter of the loser. If they're treating as equals, they exchange marriages. Chandragupta, who was polygamous like many ancient dynasts, married Seleucus's daughter Berenike. It's equally possible that Chandragupta didn't have a daughter for Seleucus or his son Antiochus to marry, but I suspect this was intentionally a slight against the Seleucids. The Roman sources all mention the marriage contract, but they don't go into any more detail. And no Indian princess is ever referenced in discussion of the Seleucids. Meanwhile, the Bhavishya Purana references Chandragupta's wedding to a Greek princess. Seleucid military forces withdrew, and I'm certain many officials went with them, but not all. A small but noteworthy cohort of veterans and settlers from previous Macedonian expeditions had built new lives in the east and stuck around. At least one satrap, Sibirtius, a Cretan Greek, was allowed to retain his position in Arachosia as the Mauryan governor. When Seleucus returned from his war against Antigonus in the west, he sent the ambassador Megasthenes to establish diplomatic relations. And Megasthenes spent plenty of time living in Sibirtius's court at Arachosian Alexandria, now a Mauryan city. We've seen proof in recent episodes that Seleucus was an extremely competent general and politician. On its surface, this seems like a gargantuan defeat for our new king. And while I'm sure he lamented the loss of Indian gold, Seleucus did get something out of this deal. I suspect that it was based on the very reason that Seleucus realized he couldn't beat Chandragupta militarily. Like the rest of his Greek and Macedonian peers, Seleucus still fostered ambitions of conquering Macedon and reuniting the Empire of Alexander. He was, after all, a Macedonian king who just happened to be in Babylon at the moment. Up to this point, we have seen how effectively elephants could turn the tide in Macedonian warfare. They were large enough to plow through horsemen and infantry phalangites with devastating effect, and the Westerners were just starting to innovate new tactics to combat this. In the war between Alexander and Darius III, we saw just two elephants in the Battle of Gaugamela, both of which got heat exhaustion before combat even began. In the campaign through the Indus Valley, we saw more, in the order of dozens, and Alexander took many back to Babylon with him. Since then, the eastern satraps imported more of the great animals from India, It's also likely, just based on numbers, that some of the Western rulers were starting to experiment with the now extinct North African elephant, either captured in Egypt and Libya or imported from trainers in Nubia. At most, we have seen just over 100 elephants deployed by a single side in even the largest battles between the Diadochoi. Most of our Indian sources up to this point are poetic, religious, and likely exaggerating their numbers a bit. But if we keep in mind the armies that the Achaemenids and Alexander were able to field at their height and use the same metrics, major Indian armies were still fielding thousands of elephants at a time. Thousands. They were operating on another order of magnitude from the Greeks. Imagine you're a Seleucid soldier. You're a veteran. You've seen it all, from great battles in Syria to over 100 elephants fighting against you with the Antigonids. You're ready to beat this Indian upstart Chandragupta, and you finally see his war camp. His army is bigger, but you have better equipment. You are confident that if Alexander the Great could conquer the Indians, Seleucus can too. Then you see it. There are 10 times as many elephants in one place than you've ever seen before. Your army has maybe a couple dozen. A Seleucid loss makes a lot more sense in that context. So in exchange for all of his southeastern territory and his own daughter, Seleucus was able to negotiate just one exchange from Chandragupta. I'm sure the Seleucid negotiators started with a higher number and haggled with their Mauryan counterparts, but in the end, Chandragupta Maurya sent Seleucus Nicator 500 elephants. It was barely a noticeable dent in the Indian elephant army, but suddenly it put Seleucus on a level beyond anything available to his rivals in the West. Over the next year or two, news of the treaty spread, and Demetrius Polyocrates, Antigonus' son, mocked Seleucus for it. He called the king in Babylon Lord of the Elephants because he had traded a huge swath of territory for a few more big animals. It hardly mattered. After all, Demetrius and his father were gods among men who would soon reunite the West and crush Seleucus. They had heard all about how much fighting it took to bring the upper satrapies to heel, and now Seleucus didn't even have India to back him up. How big a threat could he really be? All the Antigonids had to do was wrap things up in the West, which they had almost done, while Seleucus continued burning resources while he tried to consolidate in the East. Then they would sweep through and take over the whole empire once again. But then we wrap back around to episode 133. As Demetrius was on the verge of taking all of Greece and Antigonus consolidated his power in Syria, Lysimachus, now the king in Thrace, joined forces with Cassander in Macedon and invaded Anatolia, which had been left undefended in 302. Lysimachus and Cassander wrote letters to Ptolemy and Seleucus urging them to join in the war, and both men rose to the occasion. While Demetrius mocked Seleucus for giving up his territory, Seleucus had already settled the issues of Bactria and central Iran. His treaty with Chandragupta ended the threat on his eastern flank. They were still battling the Dahai Saka in the northeast, but that was nothing new. There would always be steppe raiders. So Seleucus took 480 of his approximately 600 total elephants, alongside tens of thousands of Iranian cavalry and a mix of Iranian and Macedonian infantry, into the West. If Demetrius wanted Seleucus to be the Lord of Elephants, then Seleucus would show him what that really meant. Next time, the Diadochoi will reunite, if only briefly, for the Battle of Ipsus. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you'll find things like maps, my bibliography, and the financial support page. If you just want to hear more of my voice, check out my other podcast, America Secret Wars. That's where I tell my guests about all of the forgotten and overlooked wars in American history. And if you want to support these projects or my work in general, you can head to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merchandise, or subscribe and get access to both shows with no ads, bonus episodes, Discord access, and more. No money, no problem. The absolute best way to support indie podcasts is to recommend the show to others and leave a review. Until next time, thank you all for listening to The History of Persia.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.